The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My name's Ben, obviously, as you said. I'm a researcher in digital ethics and study the attention economy, particularly commodification of attention. And that's pretty much what I'm going to talk about today. Sometimes it's called the first public-facing encounter with large-scale AI. Obviously, most people with AI, they think of like LLMs and chatbots, but actually it was social media's content ranking algorithms that were the first like public-facing AI that was kind of influencing billions of people. So I'm going to talk a bit about that today, and really I'm going to argue the AI apocalypse already happened, basically. So, you know, we're all still here. Good news. Didn't die. And that a lot of the stuff we think about, like what Dr. McNamara was saying, of like, you know, robots in the street kind of shooting people or blowing up nuclear bombs, is kind of exaggerated. I think a lot of it is just marketing, to be honest with you. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a real threat. Exactly what Dr. McNamara was talking about. Well, it's sometimes called cognitive surrender, cognitive decline. I'm going to talk about moral decline as well, actually, from the system of the attention economy, the system it puts us into, and how it actually incentivizes basically people to behave in ways that they wouldn't behave normally. So that's what I'm going to talk about. First of all, I'm going to give a kind of brief history of the internet and social media. And then I'm going to talk about what it's doing to us, how it's changing our humanity. Obviously, we're talking about humanity and being human. So what the technology is doing to our humanity. And then we're going to talk about how to stay human in the machine. So how you can kind of protect your humanity, basically, in this adversarial environment, really. So let's jump in. I did bring my own clicker with me as well, so I'm prepared. So the history of the digital revolution. Basically, the internet. The internet's like so ubiquitous now that we kind of think of it as something like that was always there, but it was actually invented in a particular time and place. The internet was invented in 1969 as part of a combined American military and academic project called ARPANET, Advanced Research Project. So in this project, they were going to link up these things called computers, but computers at the time looked like this. So a computer was the size of an entire room, basically. Not very efficient, you know, for transportation or anything else. So computers were huge. Universities typically had them. The military had them. And basically, to use one of them, they'd have a little kind of login station, and one person could use them at a time. So basically, the idea was if they linked them all up together, different people could use different computers to send information and compute things. And so this was the project they were undertaking. And basically, they linked four university computers together, UCLA, Stanford, two other ones, to share information across this network. And this UCLA student programmer, Charlie Klein, very famous guy, he tried to send the first message ever on the internet, which was login, but then the system crashed. So he only got to send two letters. So all he sent was lo, as in lo and behold. This is how the internet is born, basically. So from this kind of military academic project, people kind of immediately saw the potential here for this to change the world, to change communication, for commerce, you know, for a real opportunity for something revolutionary. And this kind of comes about in Web 1.0, which is the early internet. So 1969, the internet, again, it's like a military academic project. Like, people can't get onto this. So it takes a lot of work to build something that people can actually kind of use. If some people are old enough, you might actually remember pages that look like this. It's incredible. But the internet is the like global network, the infrastructure that comes together. But the digital world or the World Wide Web is built on top of that, basically. It's invented by a guy called Sir Tim Berners-Lee, 1989, when he's working for CERN in Switzerland. So he invents the World Wide Web, and this creates the possibility of pages, of links, of these kind of static web pages that people can visit. And this is like a huge, everybody's like, whoa, this is crazy, man. What is this? Cyberspace, you know, we're surfing the web now. And they go to a page like this and you'd get information from it. Now this looks like quaint, but at the time, like it was, you know, it was a big deal. So Web 1.0 is these static read-only websites. It's very big at the time. The technology is really bad. I don't know if anybody remembers dial-up connections. You know what I mean? There'd be this crazy like, yeah, Paul's old enough over there. There's this kind of like crazy sound. No smooth broadband, no smartphones or anything. So like it was basically a very small percentage of the population was using the internet at this time. But the potential was there. So a lot of tech VCs with loads of money poured tons of money into this, made people millionaires, made people billionaires. But they hadn't figured out how to make money with the internet. This was always the big problem, was like, how is this thing going to turn a profit, basically? It's like, okay, great, gives information to everybody. Everybody has access to this. How do we make money off it, basically? And this leads to the dot-com bubble, where basically the companies were overvalued. They all started to crash. And by 2001, people were like, the internet's done for. That's it. Obviously, that didn't happen, as you all remember. So you can see at the time in this graph, it's like, Early 2000s, about 6% of the world is on the internet. Very small number. Whereas now in 2026, it's about 75% of the world. So in the last 30 years, there's been this onboarding process of developing all these technologies, all these ways of accessing apps, smartphones, that everybody can participate in the internet. And the time that I'm saying the AI apocalypse took place is actually this period really between like 2015 and 2020, basically, when there was more people on the internet than not, basically. We crossed this kind of barrier. And anecdotally, 2016, sometimes people are like, stuff started getting weird then. I don't know what it was, but, you know, something was happening. So that's what we're gonna talk about. But basically, after Web 1.0, that fails, goes down. The internet doesn't collapse. You get Web 2.0, okay? And this is what we know is the internet now. It's mostly social media, also Google, you know, YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn. A lot of these companies start around this time. And because of these technological revolutions like broadband, wireless data, social media, smartphones are huge in this. I mean, we'll talk about that maybe a little bit more, but it creates this very different kind of environment. You know, you don't have to have a home PC. People are plugged into the internet all the time and they're feeding data into the internet that's then being used to make it better, basically. And so how Web 2.0 solved the money problem that Web 1.0 has is advertising, okay? They brought advertising in. Because I don't know if anybody thinks this is weird, like, they're the richest companies in the world, but they give away their products for free. Strange, no? You would think to become a billionaire, you'd have to be selling something. So basically, the platforms are free, your access, your membership, but what they're selling is access to your perception and action to advertisers, basically. That's the business model. And you exchange, you know, free use of it in order for this possibility for them to influence your behavior. And we're going to talk about that because they've been very successful at it. So, you know, all the time we're like, oh, it doesn't work on me, but it's working on somebody. So, you know, but basically they solve it. The growth of the internet is driven by what's called network effects. Now, this is a fancy term. It comes from a guy called Metcalfe, who's very influential, early internet building. He has a thing called Metcalfe's Law, which is that the value of the network increases with the number of people on the network and communications. So the value of Facebook or Instagram isn't in the software. The software is pretty simple. Now you can vibe code one of those platforms with generative AI in 10 minutes. The value comes from all the people that are on the network. Okay. Another reason why they have to give it away for free, they need as many people as possible on that network. A social network that's just me and my granny isn't going to be very good, okay? It needs everybody to be on there, basically, okay? So each social network needs as many customers as possible. And then think about it for the advertisers, they need people to be as long as possible on there, okay? They need people engaging on the platforms, okay? That's creating data, that's creating opportunities to influence behavior. Because these incentives really are what drive the, you know, the manipulative stuff. Okay. And part of this technological revolution is a cultural revolution that takes place, which is that everyone can have their own channel now. This is really unusual in the history of the world, really, where basically we have a situation where previously in the 20th century, this actually might be my next slide, so maybe I'll just go with that. I'm forgetting what I'm doing here. In the legacy media, the pre-internet media, newspapers, radio, television, this kind of stuff, There's a distinction between the creators of the media and the consumers of the media. And things are pretty costly. I mean, if you want to have a newspaper business, you need to have huge printing presses. You need to have all this kind of technology. If you want to have a TV broadcasting station, I mean, there's like two or three of them in the 20th century. Like, it's really expensive. It's really difficult to do. But with smartphones, with Web 2.0 platforms, with the internet connection, now everybody can do this. This is the kind of strange world we're living in now, where we have, everybody has the means of communication, essentially. One example of this I like to give is, if you grew up on television, maybe like me, I can remember a time when there was like 10 channels maybe, and then obviously you got upgraded and there's a couple hundred channels, maybe you get 1,000 channels. On YouTube now, there's 113 million channels, okay? And that's only on YouTube. So like, you know, there's other ones, basically. So you have this massive explosion, basically, of content, user-generated content, that the platforms basically are holding and are filtering for people to see, okay? So this is a radically new cultural environment. If you think about like the invention of the printing press, basically starts the modern age, starts the Protestant Reformation, you know, a lot of crazy stuff. This technological cultural change is on par with that, a lot of people think. This is a totally new way, you know, we've never had this kind of power to communicate with each other before, okay? But because we get the power to communicate, the power no longer lies in the means of media production, like the television studios and this stuff, but it lies in the means of media distribution. Basically, who gets to decide what people see and what people don't see? Yeah? Because, you know, a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it. Did it fall? If you upload something on Instagram and nobody sees it, did it happen? So you create this incentive structure where to be successful on the platforms, you have to play their game, essentially. What I call in my work, the attention game. Basically, you have to try and get people's attention. And, you know, if you know anybody who's an attention seeker, they usually don't do stuff that's like the best things to be doing, pretty much. It's like, how do you get people to look at you? You do crazy things. You know, you take your clothes off, you fight people. That's the internet. Okay. So, you're welcome. You can quote me on that. So, these are some more examples of this, like daily content upload. So, there's 720,000 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every day. 4 million gigabytes of data to Facebook. 95 million photos and videos to Instagram. You know, 500 million tweets. 4.4 million blogs. 65 billion WhatsApp messages. This is just a scale that we've never seen, basically. And this is how we ended up with the AI apocalypse. We moved from human judgment to AI judgment, essentially, by necessity, because of this technology. Because nobody, you know, nobody's watching 720,000 hours of YouTube a day, basically. You know, they have to use the machines to filter it in order to deal with the level of content. So when we talk about the legacy media, you have tastemakers, human judgment, you'd have like, you know, TV executives, film executives, academics, journalists, but that gets replaced essentially in the 2010s because of the necessity of scale with these platforms' artificial intelligence. Okay, and so this is a radical cultural shift, basically. And I'm no fan of the legacy media. I mean, it's not really my thing. But at least there was humans in the loop in some sense. Whereas now the platforms have just automated this program to capture engagement, and that decides what gets seen and what doesn't. Okay. This gives them tremendous cultural power. I mean, Tristan Harris, I don't know if you've ever seen the Social Dilemma documentary, but like he puts it that there's never in history has so few companies controlled so many people's day-to-day lives, their thoughts, their actions, what they see. You know, as you pointed out, I can't remember who made the father has that a computer can ruin your day. You know, the things you see online can ruin your day. And basically, these companies are just deciding what you see. And there's tons of, I mean, if you're interested in this stuff, the one to look up is the Facebook emotional manipulation study. Facebook did this large-scale study to see could they change people's emotions based on what they show them. So they just pick somebody randomly and just give them really terrible news, like all day, basically, or somebody else, and just give them really positive stuff. And they found that their tracking of people's moods would either improve or disimprove based on what they show them. So they basically proved that they could manipulate people's emotions based on what they're doing. Some thinkers, I don't know if you know Mary Harrington or Jordan Hall, argue that this is the end of modernity in some sense, that we've entered a qualitatively different type of society than ones that were predicated on legacy media technologies. And we're kind of reeling from it. You know, we don't really know a lot of our institutions and ways of doing things. Trust is being eroded. It's very difficult to operate in this environment, which ironically was made for us to communicate and connect to each other. So they might have got it wrong. I put this in earlier. I think this is the date that it happened, the 28th of May, 2016. Father Connor's smiling. I think he might know. No. Does anybody know what happened on the 28th of May, 2016? It's the 10-year anniversary coming up. No? It was the death of Harambe, the gorilla, unfortunately. And this is when we crossed into the other timeline and everything changed. For those of you who aren't brain-rotted like me, this is an internet conspiracy theory that when Harambe died, we entered a new timeline. And Harambe is like in some other universe trying to get back to us to kind of fix the whole thing. There's great memes, man, of him like Lord of the Rings, like Harambe the White. He comes back kind of at the end. Look this up anyway, it's good. But it's kind of eerily close to when this would have occurred. So I don't know. That was a joke, by the way. That's a bit about the internet and how it's changed things. And now, what's it doing to us? This is a term, human downgrading, that Tristan Harris coined in 2019. And I'm going to kind of lay out a little bit. This stuff is very complicated. You know, I'm publishing on it, so there's a lot of stuff in it, but I'm trying to kind of boil it down for you to give you a sense of what's happening. So Tristan Harris, I don't know, he made The Social Dilemma. He made the recent AI doc, which is very interesting. And he started the Center for Humane Technology, if anybody knows this. But in 2019, he kind of observed, he's like, everything's getting worse. He was just like, people seem to be like getting worse at communicating with each other, worse at controlling themselves, worse at solving problems. And he coined this term human downgrading to describe the cost to our humanity and our ability to solve problems, our intelligence, in the current technological environment, that it seems to be having this effect that's very hard to measure because it's across billions of people, you know, at the same time. And I'm going to describe this with the unfortunately named acronym IDF. Not that IDF. I need to get a new acronym. But incentives, design, and flow, okay? So this is how the human downgrading process kind of occurs. Yeah. So we talked about the incentives a lot. This is the business model, the attention business model. Ethan Zuckerman, the inventor of the pop-up ad, not a very popular guy, described personalized advertising as the original sin of the internet, basically. That was the thing that they chose to do that was going to lead to these problems later. Because think about what do advertisers want? They want a person who's just like completely impulsively buying and just desiring everything. So if you give them advanced technology to start manipulating and editing people, that's the type of person they're going to try and generate, essentially. And so the business model, we kind of talked about this already, it generates all these incentives to get people on, to keep them on engaging, to addict them, to manipulate them. As the saying goes, you know, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. The user here is the product. The customer is the advertiser. It's not the user. Okay. I love this quote from Jaron Lanier. He was actually the father of virtual reality. Very interesting guy. But he said, what the social media companies are selling to advertisers is the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in your own behavior and perception. And it's something that's different with the legacy media. So like a TV company that makes money reinvests the money into making better TV shows in theory. The social media company don't generate content, so they reinvest the money into the medium itself. They reinvest it to make it better at capturing more attention. That's why you see like these developments in the newsfeed and infinite scrolls and autoplays, because they're using the money to evolve to get better at capturing more and more attention, basically. That's their job. And as you can see, it works really, really well. As of this year, as far as I'm aware, the global advertising spend is now a $1 trillion industry. Okay. And you can see in 2019, it's $392 billion. Actually, in 2000, it was only $8 billion. So like this industry has grown so much. It's on par with oil and gas and with real estate. Which is just, you know, when you think about it, it's completely replaced legacy advertising. But, you know, when I was looking at this graph, I'm thinking, what's the cost of that? You know what I mean? Like, they're making more money, so they're succeeding in this kind of advertising endeavor. But what is that doing to the billions of people that are, you know, in this digital world, digital age? And I wanted a graph that was like the inverse of this in some sense. Like, could you see the consequence of it? So it's like, as their money's going up, like, what's the cost? And this is the one I settled on, which is from the Financial Times, which describes personality change in young people that they're tracking from data in the States, which is, I mean, yeah, in terms of conscientiousness, it's the ability to set and achieve goals, to inhibit distractions. Neuroticism is just negative emotion. Agreeableness is being sociable with other people. Extroversion as well, being rewarded socially. But you can see this change, becoming more distracted, less able to achieve goals, more negative emotion, more isolated, more individualistic. This is an apocalypse graph. I don't know if you could, like, I can impress that. But, and there is questions about, like, how much the effect size and stuff like that. I spoke to a personality psychologist, Colin DeYoung. He invented cybernetic big five personality theories, like, huge guy. And he says basically, yeah, the only thing that could be doing this is the smartphones and the internet. It's not enough time for anything else to have changed to be causing these effects, basically. So because it's happening across the population, it's very hard to get measurements on how this is taking place. But this is an example of one that seems to be going. And you see people reporting that they're more easily distracted, more careless, struggling to make plans and follow through and persevering. So, yeah, basically this is trying to get a big picture view of, like, what is this stuff doing to us? And why would it do it to us? This is a very interesting book. If you want to understand this, it's called Hooked. Really weird book, to be honest. He's teaching you how to addict people, basically, but he's kind of regretting it at the same time. He's kind of like, yeah, I know it's bad, but, like, I'm going to sell 200,000 copies of it anyway. So kind of weird. But basically, the model, so he argues that the social media companies, their economic value comes from linking the services to the user's daily routines and emotions, basically. They form habits, and he describes habits as automatic behaviors triggered by situational cues. So a lot of this comes from 20th century behaviorist psychology, which I'll talk about a little bit, operant conditioning, reinforcement learning. They basically took that psychological research and applied it to technology, to what's called persuasive design. And the goal is to create an internal trigger, okay? So think about it. An external trigger is like somebody texts you, you get a notification, your phone bings. That triggers you to pick it up and take an action. An internal trigger is when you get something inside of you, basically. Your own emotions trigger you to use the service as a way of relieving them, okay? So, like, you feel bored, you scroll Instagram. You feel lonely, you go on TikTok. You feel sad, you go on Reddit or something. I don't know. Probably wouldn't help. You're laughing. So don't go on Reddit if you're sad, apparently. But basically, that's what they're trying to do, because they don't need to market to you anymore if your own emotions are linked. It's called the ludic loop in gambling technology. It's where the person's emotional regulation comes to function with the use of an external thing. And it's basically, Nurayal calls it the brass ring, as in, like, the super goal that these guys have, the best goal possible, okay? And yeah, I won't go through the four steps too much, but basically they've really thought this stuff out. You know, they have the best behaviorist scientists or psychological scientists working on getting you to do this, pretty much. And to think about a habit, like, a habit that you don't want is an addiction. So addiction is kind of hard to define, but if you have a habit that's harmful to you that you don't want to have, that's an addiction, essentially. I don't know if you ever heard of the idea of a Skinner box. No? You'd be familiar with this. Skinner's experiments on rats. He could get rats and pigeons to solve, like, complex problems by starving them and basically rewarding them whenever they took particular steps. So, like, he'd punish them by shocking them with this electric grid, or he'd feed them pellets if they did things that he wanted to do. And he could train them to do, like, circus acts and navigate mazes and stuff like that. And this is what social media is doing to people who are in that environment. They're rewarding you for doing things that keep you engaging on the platform, and they're punishing you for doing things that disengage, essentially, to train that reward system, okay? Another humorous meme. This is basically scrolling TikTok, unfortunately. So, yeah, as Tristan Saras would say, you have a supercomputer pointed at your brain. And so, yeah, like, what are the consequences of living in this environment for a lot of young people? I want to talk about, actually, this is important. This is the F and IDF. I really need a new acronym. But so flow states. Is everybody here familiar with flow states? Have you heard of flow states before? Very popular idea. Something people aren't familiar with is dark flow states. It's a different an idea. There's a normativity there of flow states that aren't good for you, basically. So a flow state is like a state of optimal subjective experience. Example I give to people a lot is skiing. I don't know if anybody skis here, but any kind of sport, when you're in the zone, like, your attention is completely locked in, you're not anxious, You're not bored. You're totally in the moment. It feels great, basically. You're not thinking about anything else. Shuts down your self-consciousness and your kind of, yeah, your thinking mind. And this is an optimal state of subjective experience. Great if you're learning a skill and you're doing something. Not so good, you know, if you're just scrolling on TikTok for 10 hours. But basically, what these companies are trying to do is to get you into a flow state so you lose track of time, you become engaged in what you're doing. It feels really good, but then afterwards you're kind of drained. You don't feel that good after it. Maybe there's a bit of guilt associated with it. But you've kind of lost control of yourself, essentially. Your judgment and your ability to kind of shift tasks is a problem for engineers to solve in this state. And so the digital world, this also is true of video games, a lot of stuff. They replicate the feeling of flow, the experience of flow of being in a flow state, but without any corresponding transferable skills, okay? So like when I'm skiing, I'm in a flow state because I'm getting better at skiing. I'm like on the edge of my competence, okay? So like if you're on a ski slope and you're on a super dangerous ski slope, you're going to be anxious, you're going to be scared. If you're on a really easy ski slope, you're going to get bored. But if you're on just the right ski slope, you're fully engaged. That's where you get a flow state. And so they're trying to do that. They're getting you to that edge of your competence when you're scrolling on things, but with no corresponding increase in skill in anything else. The only skill that you're cultivating is becoming fitted more and more to the platform. And so there's a cost to this, what's called anti-flow, okay? So the user becomes fitted to the digital world, but then less fitted to the non-digital world, okay? And I'm going to give you an example of this because it sounds kind of weird, but when you then return from the digital world to the non-digital world, you experience anti-flow, which is anxiety, depression. You feel bad, basically. You feel scared. Things are more difficult in the non-digital environment. And this starts many vicious loops. One example I'll give you is socializing. So say if you grow up as a young person and you're used to almost entirely socializing through platforms. You have time to think about what you're going to do. You can curate your image. There's a distance between you and the other person. And then, you know, somebody rings your doorbell and you have to go and have a conversation with them. Suddenly you're like, whoa, I have social anxiety. I'm afraid. I don't have enough experience in this situation to be comfortable to get into a flow state. So they're trained by the regime and the platform into expecting those things, but then you become conditioned by it. You practice till that's normal for you. And then when you go into the real world, the non-digital world, it's more difficult. It's more challenging. And what do you think happens then if you find the non-digital world really challenging and the digital world really easy and rewarding? iPad kid, yes. You spend all your time in that world because that's where you feel good. That's where you feel like you're rewarded. That's where you feel like you have value, okay? So that's a really bad incentive structure for people to get into. And the fact that the companies profit the more they do that, really, really dodgy. So yeah, basically, and an interesting point, flow oftentimes is what people are talking about when they're the phenomenological experience of meaning. Somebody says like, this feels really meaningful to me, it's that they're in a flow state, that they're fully engaged in it. And so these things are providing a sense of meaning for people that we're going to talk about might be missing in the offline world. Okay, so I'm going to give you a mythological metaphor. I have no idea what time. We got a bit of time. Mythological metaphor. Anybody know the story of Hansel and Gretel? Yeah, Hansel and Gretel fan over here. Very nice, respect. Yeah, it's a great story. Two kids lost in the woods, abandoned by their father and their stepmother. There's always a bad stepmother. They're running out of bread and she's like, these kids, man, we just got to get rid of them. Send them off to the woods. And so the dad's like, all right, fine, I'll throw the kids away. And they're wandering and they're lost in the woods, okay? So think about it, you're lost in the woods. It's more difficult. You have no food, you're a kid. And what do they see? Come on, this guy?
Gingerbread house.
Gingerbread house or a candy house. I mean, you know, there's nothing better. If you run it, you're hungry, you're lost. You find a house literally made of candy and you're a child. That's the digital world, essentially. The uncertainty of people's day-to-day lives, the typical experience of being a human being, difficult, challenging at times. The digital environment comes along and offers this candy house, basically, that's free, that requires very little motoric cost, just your finger. And it's calibrated to every desire that you have to try and meet it as quickly as possible. Whatever you're interested in, it's going to give you more of that, okay? But what's the cost of living in the candy house? What happens to the kids? What does the witch that, because I mean, the witch owns the candy house, doesn't she? What does the witch do to the children?
It's life or death.
Yeah, fattens them up. Yeah, doesn't she? Fattens them up because she's going to cook them. So over time, returning to the non-digital world gets more difficult. So your cognitive system is becoming fat. It's basically becoming, it's like low calorie. It gets used to this smooth, easy, frictionless world. And then going back to the non-digital world becomes harder and harder and harder. Okay, you experience anti-flow, and then you're going to have to go through a very difficult adjustment to get back out the other side. And so, yeah, this is what's been done essentially without, you know, anybody's knowledge. It's been called the largest unregulated science experiment in history, where this has been deployed on billions of people. And the goal for them then, that ludic loop, is that you're going to use the platform to regulate your emotions, becomes part of your day-to-day life, becomes part of your personality. And basically that's how they've become the richest companies in the world. And so, yeah, slightly depressing news, but what about something slightly more positive? Becoming fully human inside the machine. This is Jonah escaping from the belly of the whale. We've all been there, you know. I think we're collectively in the belly of some sort of whale or machine. So I like this quote. It's kind of a weird quote because it's from an interview as well, so apologies, but I'm going to read it to you from David Foster Wallace. He said, this is in an interview with Lady Judith something. As the internet grows and as our ability to be linked up, says, like, I mean, you and I could have done this through email and I never would have had to meet you and that would have been easier for me, right? Like, at a certain point, we're going to have to build up some machinery inside our guts to help us deal with this, because the technology is just going to get better and better and better, and it's going to get easier and easier and more convenient and more pleasurable to be alone with images on a screen given to us by people who do not love us but want our money. Which is all right in low doses, right? But if that's the basic main staple of your diet, you're going to die. In a meaningful way, you're going to die. Okay? He said this in 1996. So never saw a smartphone, never saw, you know, ChatGPT or any of these things. But very prescient of, like, we need to build up something inside of us to be able to resist this stuff. Okay? Basically. And obviously, if you know David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest, his famous book, has a killer videotape in it that people can't stop watching that kills them. Kind of the idea. So this is it from my thesis, really, is like the recommendations, I suppose, of like how to handle this strange digital transformation, like particularly the downside of it, because I always end up talking about the downside, but there is a lot of positive stuff as well that's, you know, very useful, but we do have to be realistic about the problems and deal with them. So regulation is a big important part of this, because like the companies can't police themselves. They make money by addicting people. Somebody has to step in basically and get rid of some of the harsher features of it. Things like infinite scrolls, autoplay features, you know, you could change these things today and it would completely transform the internet, basically. It hasn't happened yet, and so there's challenges. I also think removing children and teens is super important. You know, there's a lot of controversy over that, maybe the under 16s ban. But if you look at the research, like TikTok's own research basically proved the younger the user is, the more valuable they are to the company. So the harder it is for the younger the user is, the harder it is for them to stop engaging, basically. The more difficult it is. Because you think about it, their prefrontal cortex is less developed. They can't trade off other stuff. So they can't protect themselves from it. Somebody has to do something, basically. Secondly, education. Exactly what Dr. McNamara was talking about. You know, staying human, the humanities, might be a good idea. That thing they're always trying to get rid of in the university might be important, actually. We might really need that to remain human in this technological soup. I also think wisdom training, sapiential education. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be a Catholic and you have the sacraments and you have mass and you have all of that, I mean, I think that's the arc, to be honest with you, in this digital flood, really, is like, if you just follow that way of life, you'll be all right. But a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't so well protected in that way. But it's very important for some attentional training to be able to deploy your attention to say, like, am I using my attention well? Am I paying attention to the right things? Or am I just being chronically distracted, basically? I know people these days struggle to kind of pay attention long term to things, maybe when they're working and stuff. So you have to work that muscle, like, and train the attention. And that could require institutions that actually help people to train their attention. Third one, meaning. the meaning crisis, which is something I talk about a lot on podcasts and interviews and things like that. We do have a meaning crisis. And I mean, I think it's funny, like if you hear Mark Zuckerberg talk about like why he made Facebook, he says he made Facebook to connect people. I mean, slightly ironic given what it's done, but the point, a lot of people who are suffering a meaning crisis feel disconnected. They feel disconnected from themselves, disconnected from other people, disconnected from tradition or for other wider human enterprise. And so if we don't address the kind of offline meaning crisis that people are suffering with, people are just going to make more addictive substitutes, basically. You know, it's not a new thing, basically. It's a way of using pleasure to fill that hole in your heart, unfortunately, which doesn't work. And so the meaning crisis is a big driver of the digital exodus in young people. They find the structure of the digital world, you know, it's rewarding. There's endless novelty. There's social status. There's fame if you can get it. You know, it's very shiny. There's beautiful people with six-pack abs and jet skis. And, you know, that could be appealing if that's your value system. And so we really need a cultural change here beyond that. And I'm not talking about just in this room, I suppose, in the wider secular culture, to change the values that have allowed these things to become so dominant in the first place. Right? So I think it's a real reckoning for secular society that doesn't have an answer to this meaning question a lot, you know? And unfortunately, if you don't find that adventure of your life, that quest, there's going to be a lot of technologists and attentional architects that will use up your time for you, okay? So, yeah. And I think, I mean, to finish on a more positive spin, I think if you were to fix the more toxic aspects of the internet, the more challenging things, the business model problems, if people actually became more virtuous, crazy idea, I mean, we're trying that for thousands of years, but if people did that and were more responsible online, you would have this feedback loop. It's actually the opposite of the feedback loop where things have been getting worse online and then they get worse offline, and then people get worse and they make the internet worse and you get this kind of downgrading. You could have the opposite effect where really positive stuff online impacts people positively who form more positive communities who impact the internet positively. And it could go the other way, I think. It's definitely not impossible. And I think this virtue of Sofferson is really important. I don't know, you probably, maybe if you're not a nerd like me, you probably haven't heard of Sofferson. But basically, the Greeks had two words for self-control. One was enkratia, and the other is Sofferson. Enkratia is like self-control. It's like white knuckle, inhibitory. Like I see the chocolate cake, and I'm like, don't eat the chocolate cake. Don't do it. Whereas Sofferson is where I'm so transformed, essentially, that I'm not even tempted by those things anymore. You know, I'm genuinely oriented to and tempted by the good. I'm tempted by what's right. I've kind of gone through that habit training. And now I'm in a position where I'm actually oriented properly. Like St. Augustine says, you know, love God and do what you will. Once you love God, then your will is oriented properly. That's okay. And that's the kind of, you know, that's going to become, that's essentially how we get through this. And I love this, obviously, the end of Paradiso and Dante. But already my desire and will were rolled evenly like a wheel that is moved by the love that moves the sun and other stars. That's what he's talking about in Sofferson, that you're moved by love and not by lower goods. Okay? In the digital age, your desire and will is going to be moved by the machine, or it's going to be moved by that love. And so each of us has to choose. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.